Hello everyone, it's Helen here in Truro, here with the second part of my podcast on the Taking of Christ by Caravaggio. In this section, we're going to focus on Giotto's masterpiece of the same subject, which is known as the Betrayal of Christ or the Judas Kiss. It's situated in the Scrivani or Arena Chapel in Padua. It dates from 1303 to 1306, measures 200 by 185 centimetres, and is work done in the true fresco style. This is where paint is applied to wet plaster, so when it dries, it becomes an integral part of the wall. Now, in order to appreciate fully this masterpiece, it helps to understand its context, because it doesn't stand in isolation. It was one masterpiece of many in a cycle of paintings that were commissioned by Enrico Scrivani for a chapel he had built in 1302 next to his new family palace in Padua. Enrico's enormous wealth had been inherited from his father, Reginaldo, a notorious usurer or moneylender, whose wicked activities were later immortalized by Dante in his Divine Comedy. Enrico was a banker himself, so no doubt guilty of the activities that were regarded as a sin in the eyes of the church. So the building of the chapel, dedicated to the Madonna of Charity, and also known as the Arena Chapel, because it was on the site abutting an ancient Roman arena, was motivated by Enrico's desire to atone for his father's sins, restore the family reputation, and save their immortal souls. So he instructed Giotto to decorate the interior of the chapel with a series of frescoes illustrating the central theme of the redemption of the world. The cycle begins at the east end with God's mission to Gabriel and the Annunciation, and it concludes on the west wall with a monumental depiction of the Last Judgment. Enrico has included himself in this section, presenting a model of the chapel to the Virgin Mary in her role as intercessor for humans, and he wears purple robes, the colour of penitence. On the north and the south walls, Giotto presented a series of frescoes in three tiers. The upper tier shows scenes in the life of the Virgin Mary and her parents, Joachim and Anna. The middle tier focuses on the life and ministry of Christ. And then the subject for the lowest tier is the Passion of Christ. And it's here where the Betrayal of Christ is situated. In each narrative cycle, Giotto selected the stories for their emotional appeal and arranged them in an order that would produce the maximum dramatic effect. To ensure a clear narrative flow, he arranged the frescoes clockwise sequentially, so the viewer could follow the progress of the narrative by moving from one painting to the next. To enhance more fully the flow of the narrative, Giotto placed the main characters in the foreground of the frescoes. He had the action move invariably from left to right and maintained a continuity from one fresco to the next by having similar backgrounds. So the frescoes are like a cartoon strip or a live-action movie. You really get a sense of the passage of time and the movement and action of the main characters. And the frescoes have a degree of animation unprecedented for art of that period. Christ is usually shown in profile in the frescoes, and this derives from the idea of Roman coinage, where emperors were depicted in this way. It was regarded as being the most noble way of presenting the human figure. So a clever allusion to Christ's status, nature, and character. Now, all this background information helps us better understand Giotto's motives and intentions, because we can see the frescoes from the perspective of the viewer to the chapel, who had approached the betrayal of Christ as the next in a series leading up to Christ's trial and execution. Before we turn to consider this fresco, I'd like to say a brief word regarding the colours. Now, these have lasted very well over the years, given the technical nature of fresco painting. But there are two notable exceptions. The first concerns the colour blue, which is used extensively in the chapel decoration. This colour was applied when the plaster was dry or secco. This meant the paint didn't become an integral part of the wall and was less durable. It has been prone to fade or flake off over the years. There were two main reasons why the colour blue was applied when the plaster was dry. First, because of its cost. The blue pigment was very expensive, and because fresco in the true style involved using a lot of paint to absorb into the wet plaster, it was cheaper to apply it when the plaster was dry. And the second, and arguably more important reason, was that it simply wasn't chemically possible to achieve the purity of colour acquired by mixing the pigment with wet plaster. The azurite element tended to turn the pigment green when it came into contact with moisture, so a much more vibrant, unadulterated shade was achieved by applying the pigment when the plaster was dry. In the short term, this approach was very effective. In the long term, it had serious consequences. The deterioration is particularly noticeable in the betrayal of Christ, if you look at the robes of Peter and Christ, and also consider that the sky would originally have been a much brighter blue. The second area where colour deterioration is noticeable concerns the silver leaf. The gold leaf, applied extensively through the frescoes, has lasted remarkably well. Not so the silver leaf. Over the years, it's oxidised and tarnished to black. So in the Last Supper fresco, for example, there is nothing sinister behind the fact that the disciples appear to be wearing black halos. They were once silver and have now turned black. And in the betrayal of Christ, the soldiers who appear to be wearing black helmets were originally wearing silver. So you just have to imagine how striking they must have originally appeared. The dazzling silver set against the vibrant blue sky. And the silver would have added an audio element to the fresco, because it would far better represent the materials of the weaponry and bring to our imagination the clashing of the swords in conflict. It's also worth noting that the disciples, who were wearing silver halos in the Last Supper scene, have been upgraded to gold in the betrayal of Christ. And this was partly done, no doubt, to help them stand out from the soldiers wearing their silver helmets. All this background information will help us more fully appreciate and understand the specific fresco of the betrayal of Christ, particularly from the perspective of a visitor to the chapel. So let's now take a closer look at this magnificent work. Now, if I view this fresco with no reference to its background or context, I'm drawn most forcefully to the figures of Judas and Christ. For a start, they're in the centre of the picture, facing each other in a somewhat confrontational style. But what really brings me into focus on the couple is Judas's bright, full-length yellow cloak. Prior to the kiss of betrayal, Judas has greeted Christ with an embrace, and in doing so, has engulfed his master in this voluminous yellow material. See how the folds of the material cleverly bring our gaze up to the shoulders and head of Christ. Indeed, there's not much else we can see of his body. He's quite literally drowned in drapery. And while the painting is otherwise known as the Judas Kiss, it could equally be called the Judas Hug, because that gesture is far more prominent in this fresco than the kiss to come. A kiss that is hinted at by the puckering lips of Judas. So the garment is a very clever device used by Giotto to bring us into the painting, to make us focus on the faces of Judas and Christ and the interaction between the two men, because the rest of their bodies are largely hidden from view. So Giotto immediately takes us to the emotional core of the drama, the betrayal of Christ by one of his closest friends. And as I mentioned in part one of the podcast, this is where Giotto and Caravaggio stand on common ground. They both make the interaction between Christ and Judas the centrepiece of their painting. They also both choose to depict in their paintings what they consider to be the most dramatic moment in the story. Where they differ is their selection of that moment. For Giotto, it's the moment before Judas kisses Christ. For Caravaggio, it's the moment immediately after. But both artists present a Christ who has foreknowledge of Judas's betrayal, and they both show Judas's reaction to becoming aware of that foreknowledge. It makes for gripping drama, and we'll look at the way that the artists handle the interaction between Judas and Christ a bit later on. but I would first like to consider how a visitor to the chapel might have a slightly different perspective on seeing this painting for the first time. Making their progress clockwise around the chapel, the visitor would have moved from the Last Supper to the washing of the disciples' feet, straight on to the betrayal of Christ. In this cycle, Giotto leaves out the prayers in the Garden of Gethsemane scene. As I mentioned earlier, the movement in the frescoes tends to be from left to right, and this is maintained in the previous two frescoes. So in the Last Supper, Christ is shown at the left-hand side of the table. For the washing of the disciples' feet, he's moved across to the right. And in the betrayal of Christ, he's starting his progress from the left-hand side to the right-hand side of the fresco. And then they would notice that that progress had been stopped by the arrival of Judas and the soldiers. So where the perspective of the visitor to the chapel would differ compared with someone viewing it out of context is that rather than being primarily struck by the confrontation between Judas and Christ, they would be aware of the obstruction presented by Judas and the soldiers to Christ's advancement. And Giotto wants his viewer to be aware of that obstruction. It's significant and symbolic, because it recognises that Judas's betrayal has brought to an end Christ's ministry, or at least that part of his ministry concerned with teaching, preaching, and healing. Christ is now about to enter the final and most crucial stage of his ministry, a stage that will end with his suffering, death, and resurrection. And it's crucial because without it, all that has gone before would be rendered futile. So a viewer to the chapel would possibly see this painting much more in terms of Judas and the soldiers as representatives of the forces of evil coming together to oppose and obstruct Christ in his ministry and bring it to an end. So on one level, this very much represents a battle between the forces of good and evil. And when we consider Caravaggio's painting, we'll see that this universal theme of the struggle between good and evil, as well as the personal interaction between Judas and Christ, is a strong feature of his work too. And so if we bear in mind this universal struggle between good and evil, and if we look outside of the central figures of Judas and Christ, and we'll return to these later on, we'll see how Giotto is wanting to give us a very strong impression of how Christ is outnumbered, overwhelmed, and oppressed by his enemies. So we have the armed men and the authorities coming in from the right-hand side, coming in from the left, coming in from behind Judas and Christ, and also from our side too. And this is suggested by the fact that we have a man standing on the left-hand side in the foreground with his back towards us. So viewing things from our perspective, albeit closer up. And then on the right-hand side, we have a man in authority, possibly a high priest, whose left arm is nudging into our space, identifying there with a crowd standing on the viewing side of the picture. So Christ is completely surrounded by his enemies. And yet there he stands, calm, dignified, composed, no sign of fear, anxiety, or anger, no attempt to resist or retaliate. Giotto may have left out the Garden of Gethsemane scene, but he's not forgotten its conclusions. For after that period of turmoil and anxiety, Christ concluded his prayers with resolution to submit to his Father's will and follow the path to the cross. Christ had every reason to be angry and was certainly capable of that emotion. If you look at the fresco of the expulsion of the moneylenders from the temple, there Giotto depicts a Christ who is so angry he's made a fist and is about to punch one of the culprits in the face. To make matters worse, this act of violence has so scared a child in the temple that the poor infant is hiding between the legs of one of the disciples standing next to Christ. Now, this wasn't part of the gospel narrative, but it makes for good drama visually. And it also strengthens the argument in the Betrayal of Christ fresco that here was a man capable of the strongest human emotions. And yet he is willing to suppress those natural emotions in order to submit not so much to the authorities as to his Father's will, in order that the scriptures might be fulfilled and his mission on earth, the salvation of the world, be accomplished. As a human, he suppresses his natural instinct to resist arrest, to retaliate against the injustice he faces. But he's also the Son of God. Giotto never forgets his divine status. He provides him with a golden halo, which seems to act as a protective barrier against his enemies, which surround him on all sides. And his enemies number in their hundreds. We have not only the figures given in full in the foreground, but many more implied through the clusters of helmets, a clever device which gives a sense of depth, dimension and space to the painting. In their present shade of cauldron black, the helmets present a formidable, oppressive force. How much more powerful their impact would have been in their original shade of silver, so striking against the vibrant blue sky. As I mentioned earlier, in reference to the silver leaf, the silver would have added an audio element to the painting, bringing to mind the clashing of the swords. And there is a more explicit audio reference provided by the figure of the soldier just about to blow his horn, implying a battle cry, a call to arms. And amidst this sea of silver, we are able to pick out the gold-haloed figures of Christ and his disciples. And the gold halos not only help identify Christ and the disciples, but also show how greatly outnumbered they are by their enemies. Because there are just three halos in the painting. One of those halos belongs to Christ, the other two to disciples who have been by his side when Judas and the soldiers arrive. One of those disciples is Peter, shown on the left-hand side, fully engaged in the combat, because he's just sliced off the ear of Malchus, the slave of the high priest. In the washing of the disciples' feet, Peter looks somewhat grumpy. Here, he looks angry, very angry. The Gospels don't give a specific motive for Peter's violent act. In his fresco, Giotto supplies it. Because we can see that Malchus is moving forward to grab Christ. And so Peter is trying to protect his master from attack by striking first. Peter can only do one thing at a time. Had he looked to the left-hand side of Malchus, he would have noticed another man with his club raised, about to strike Christ on the head, which emphasizes once again just how vulnerable Christ is in this scene. The other disciple is only partially shown in the painting. To the left of St. Peter, we see part of his halo, part of his face. The rest is implied on the other side of the picture frame. To the right of Peter, we see the face of a man, one of the multitude, in profile, who at first sight appears to be looking at Peter, but he's actually not. He's looking beyond intently at the disciple, only partly shown in the painting. He's leaning forward, clearly intent on apprehending the disciple and preventing his escape. So this figure, shown half in, half out, represents a man on the run. He's taking flight in order to join his fellow disciples who've already made their departure. So this half in, half out figure is a very clever device used by Giotto to symbolise the abandonment of Christ by all of his disciples. The only one who doesn't take flight is Peter, but even his loyalty is tested and found wanting. Instead of supporting and defending Christ, he denies knowledge of him three times. Then we have a short, stocky, hooded figure standing with his back towards us, between Peter and Christ. With his left hand, he grabs the garment of a man who's not shown in the painting. Again, a person imagined off stage. And this probably refers to the incident in St. Mark's Gospel, where there is a young man wearing nothing but a linen garment, who in his panic to evade arrest, drops his garment and runs naked into the night. Possibly for reasons of decorum, Giotto doesn't depict him in the painting, but implies his presence through the grabbing action of the hooded man. Giotto often places figures in his painting with their backs towards us, viewing things from our perspective, albeit closer up. It's a way of drawing us closer into the painting and engaging more fully in the drama and emotion of the story. The other figure, who stands somewhat outside of the crowd, is on the right-hand side. A bearded man wearing a pinky red robe lined with gold trimming and a green hood. He points his finger towards Christ as an instruction to the soldiers to arrest him. Judging by his distinguished dress and air of command, this is a man of importance, high status, one of authority, possibly a high priest. The colours of his robe are significant. Giotto uses colour in his paintings, not just for visual impact, but for its symbolism. Notice, for example, the horizontal ribbon of red that flows through the painting, almost cutting it in two. Red can have a number of meanings. It can stand, for example, for danger, and the crowd certainly represent a threat to Christ. It can stand for power and authority. Note the distinct red tunic of the soldier standing immediately behind Judas, and the pink red robes of the high priest. Both have the power and authority to arrest Christ. And most significantly of all, red is a symbol of blood, an allusion to Christ's sacrifice on the cross. So in this context, the high priest, as an accuser of Christ, literally has blood on his hands. And the green of his hood is also symbolic. Usually, green is seen as a life-affirming colour, a symbol of renewal, rebirth. But it can also have negative connotations. When associated with the idea of the changing nature of the seasons, it can, when applied to the human character, refer to a person who is disloyal, fickle, inconstant, who is willing to change their mind, transfer their allegiance in order to suit their personal circumstances. So the high priest doesn't just represent an opponent to Christ, but a person who cannot be trusted, whose integrity and honesty is called into question, because his nature is untrustworthy. And the gold trimming of his red robe hints at the motive behind the corruption of his power: greed. But before we get too carried away with our condemnation of this man, Giotto makes us pause. Look at the way that the left arm of the high priest seems to nudge into our space. A clever, subtle use of foreshortening. It's Giotto blurring the boundary between the picture plane and the viewer's space, a boundary that Caravaggio will cross completely. But even if that arm is only tentatively pushing into our space, the conclusion implied by this trespass is stated more forcefully. By associating the accusing high priest with us, Giotto is implicating us in the crime of Christ's condemnation. The argument is simple. It's a logical conclusion of Christian theology. For if Christians believe that Christ came to save the whole of humankind, to atone for the sins not just of his own generation, but of past generations and generations to come, then if Christians wish to enjoy the benefits of salvation, they also have to accept responsibility for his condemnation and death. In short, sin made Christ's death a necessity, and therefore every human, being sinful by nature, is responsible for his death. As we'll see, this argument, which is gently implied in Giotto's painting, is argued more forcefully in Caravaggio's. Now, when we come to look at Caravaggio's painting, we'll notice that the faces of the soldiers are barely visible beneath their helmets. It's as though they are depersonalised, dehumanised by their armour. Representing, if you like, the forces of evil, their individual identities are irrelevant. But while Giotto wants to give us a good impression of the size of the multitude gathered in opposition to Christ, he doesn't seek to depersonalise them in the process. He gives the figures shown in full, individual facial features, personalities, temperaments. Look at the young torchbearer, for example, standing to the right of the high priest. A handsome young man with a full head of hair, with eyebrows raised and chin lowered. He wears a very intense expression. Perhaps he's very focused on the task in hand. Or maybe he's just annoyed because the soldier in front of him has just trodden on his foot. And to his right stands an older man with a receding hairline and a very sharp pointed nose, whose jaw is dropped in astonishment at the events taking place in front of him. And then we have a much older man on the extreme right-hand side of the painting, with a shiny bald head and a thick, curly, Father Christmas-like beard. So by showing individuals within this crowd of all ages, Giotto is reminding us that the humble, as well as the high and mighty, were involved in Christ's condemnation. Ordinary people, whom many of the visitors to the chapel could relate to. Well, Giotto packs a huge amount of detail into this painting. And I think it would be a good idea to take a break at this point to give you time to reflect on some of these ideas in more detail. On our return, we'll address the specific challenge Giotto faced in packing so much detail into his fresco without allowing any of it to distract from the central themes of the story. So I very much hope to enjoy your company for the second part of this podcast on Giotto and the third in the series of The Taking of Christ. Until then, take care, stay safe, and have a wonderful week. Goodbye.